Glad that you've chosen to come and be with us this morning. We are in the midst of a series of sermons in which we're looking as closely as we can at the images of God in the stories that Jesus told. Before we get into the image that we'll look at this morning, I want to tell you again, those of you who have been here, and for the first time, those who are here this morning just visiting or here for the first time, I want to tell you why we're looking at these stories. The simple conviction that I shared when we began the series, which will be with us all along, is this. When people have the wrong idea about who God is, that leads to the wrong actions in the world. On the other hand, when people have the right picture of who God is in their mind, it changes the way they live in the world, which does at least two things. One, it changes their own experience of life day in and day out. And I would bet that there's not a single person in here who couldn't use some change in their experience of life. Secondly, and I would say, according to the scriptures, more importantly, it changes the way we carry ourselves in this world, which also is in desperate need of change. And when you and when I and when we as a church have the right picture of who God is, we become something different in the world. And I'm convinced that we become what the world needs rather than one more voice clamoring for the world's attention in this endless cacophony of nonsense. And so this morning we'll look again at a story that Jesus told to see the picture of the God that he had in his mind when he was among the people that he taught. Just briefly for review, the first week we looked together at a picture of God like a shepherd who went after a lost sheep or a woman who went in search of a lost coin. And the idea there was the God that Jesus believed in was a God who was in search of people who were lost, in search of you and me and everyone in this world. After that, last week, we looked clearly at a picture of God as the one who has given every person some work to do and a God who expects us to get to work. In that story that we looked at last week, we saw on the one hand that those who had gotten to work with the gifts that God had given them, they would stand before God one day on the day of reckoning, and God would share his joy with them and give them more work to do. On the other hand, we saw that those who had gone through life neglecting the gifts that he had given them could expect God's disappointment and anger even. And the gifts they had would be taken away, and instead of having a share in his joy, they would be sent off into a lonely existence for all of eternity. And in this picture we saw last week, I mentioned at the end that we are left with this question, who is it that should expect to have some share in God's presence? And that is the question that I want to begin with this morning, and I want to let the story that Jesus tells us this morning answer this. Again, the question is this. Who should expect to have some place in God's presence? Who's allowed to be there with God? I would say it's a fair bet that most of us think of immediately the person who's good enough. And that is not a new thought. That's been around in the minds of people for a very long time. The story that we're going to look at this morning will address this and some other things as well. And before we look at it, and by the way, if you have a Bible and you want to open to Luke 14, that's a good idea. If you don't have a Bible or if you can't see it in here, I'll have the text up on the screen, but I want to set the stage before we look at what the text says. The scene in which Jesus tells the story that we're going to consider is this. As many of you know, he wandered in his days throughout the Judean countryside and went from one city to the next, small villages really. And in those villages, he would teach. He would find groups of people like this and talk to them about who God was. Now, in the villages that he went to, there weren't hotels or inns like we have in our cities. Instead, when evening came, after a day of teaching, Jesus would rely upon the hospitality of the religious people in that community. Of course, the places he went, they had their ideas about who God was already. And one of those ideas was that when a religious person comes to your community, you set a meal for them and you host the dinner. Well, in the story that we're going to look at, the setting is this. Jesus had been teaching. He ends up in the evening in the house of one of the religious men of that community. And around the table, all of those folks who work in the synagogue, that would be like the church then, they've all gathered around to sit and to have a meal with this rabbi who'd been teaching. They wanted to get to know him. They wanted to hear what his ideas were. And so as the meal unfolded and Jesus sat there, no doubt all eyes were on him. He was the sort of visiting preacher, the traveling teacher in that place. And so they watched to see what he would say. Now Jesus also watched. And what he saw around this table was that the men who seemed to be the most religious outwardly, the ones who wore the robes and who were the leaders in the community, they took the best seats at the table. While those who were a bit shabbier and maybe not so polished or didn't seem outwardly so godly, they were pushed off to the side and in some cases weren't even around the table. They were standing on the perimeters. He noticed this. Then he also noticed that these religious men who seemed to feel that they were quite important, they gave all of their attention to Jesus, and he perceived in their attention that what they were really after was some form of payback. He noticed in them the impulse to be good to someone who might pay you back. By the way, have you ever seen this happen in your own experience of life? People taking the best seats for themselves and then giving kindness to the one they hope will pay them back. Jesus saw that evening as he sat around that dinner table. And so he said something. He said something like this. He said, when you're invited to a dinner, you shouldn't always take the best seats. And then he looked at them and he said, and when you host a dinner, you shouldn't just invite people who can pay you back. You shouldn't invite people who you know can't pay you back. Now, I want you to imagine you're one of those men. It would get under your skin, wouldn't it? There's some silence. Folks are looking at him. And that picks up where the story comes. Now, this is in Luke chapter 14. And this is verse 15. In that silence, after Jesus makes these comments, there's some quiet. And then, this is what it says. One of the dinner guests, on hearing this, said to him, "Blessed is anyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God." Now, I want to share a few cultural insights that will help this be a little plainer to you. Then, as in now, when you're at a dinner and there's conversation going, there's always that person who kind of says something to keep it moving along. Have you experienced this? They bring up something, they say something, not because they mean to end the conversation, but because they want to start it or send it in a new direction. And what's happening here is exactly that. When a teaching rabbi was invited to a dinner, and the guests wanted to hear that teacher's opinions about a particular subject, when there was a lull in the conversation, a statement about that subject would be made, not to say all there was to say about it, but to open up the conversation. And so here at this dinner table, after Jesus mentioned something about meals here, one guest said something about eating bread in the kingdom of God. And what that guest said was, "Blessed is the one who does that." That's another way of saying supremely fortunate and happy. Oh, it's the best thing in the world if you get to be a person who eats dinner or eats bread with God in the kingdom of heaven. This guest wants to hear what Jesus thinks about this popular subject. And that is what Jesus thinks about, and I put this title up here to keep it in our minds, what Jesus thinks about the banquet that will happen at the end of days. Now let me share this to catch us up to the place where those dinner guests were that evening when Jesus told his story. You see, that man who asked the question or raised the issue and everyone else around the table would have had their opinions about a banquet that was going to happen when the world's days came to an end. Perhaps you've heard the term messianic banquet. Has anyone here heard that? When I first heard that, I thought it was something about an extraordinarily messy banquet. It does not mean that. Messianic banquet was this image that the people to whom Jesus spoke in his day had of a meal that would happen at the end of time. When the Messiah, God's anointed one, came back, one of the images that they had in their popular history about what that would be like was the image of a banquet. A meal at which there would be a celebration, at which God would finally become king and reign as such. And this moment when God came to accept his authority in their minds was like a banquet. It was going to be like a meal. And they had this in their minds, first of all, from one of the prophets that had written the scriptures that they read. And that was the prophet Isaiah. Maybe some of you have read the book of Isaiah, but if you've read it, you hear one of the clearest and early expressions of what the banquet at the end of days is going to be like. Now, I want you to do something. Notice that in your mind, you probably have an image about what heaven is going to be like. Is there anyone here who has that? When you think of heaven, you have a picture maybe? Anyone have clouds? No? Yes? Think of it for a moment, what your image is like. All of those people around that table had an image of what it would be like when God came back. This is the image that they got from Isaiah. Now, listen to this. In that book of Isaiah, there's a description of a meal that takes place on a mountain. And on this mountain, it was said, God himself would come back and set for on this mountain would set forth a meal of unprecedented goodness. Did anyone else here like to eat? I love to eat. The meal is described. This is what heaven is pictured like, or this is what the time when the days will end is pictured like. God will come and set a meal, and at this meal there will be meat. And I'm sorry if you're a vegetarian, but there will be, it says not just meat, but there will be meat where there's marrow filling the bones. And there will also be wine. I know there's some Baptist folks who think maybe it's just non-fermented grape juice, but I think it's wine. And well-aged wine, Isaiah says. And not only well-aged, but well-aged and strained clear. And this banquet will be set in such a way that the food that is there is unlike any food that any person has ever had. It's so delectable. It so satisfies the hunger that every person has. It is so good for nourishing and strengthening and causing joy and celebration. And this is the picture that Isaiah painted. There will be this meal that is set when God comes. And it gets better. Listen to this. If that's not good enough, he says this too. He says that this meal, the shame that people have been carrying all their lives, will be taken away from them. Is there anyone in here this morning who has some shame? Gone at this meal. You will come into this meal, and this food will be there, and all of the shame, every mistake you've made that you know about, even the ones that you don't know about, the things that you are trying so hard to hide from everyone in the world and from God too, those things will be removed and taken away, this image says. And it goes on. It says, then all of the tears of every eye at that banquet will be wiped dry. Is there anything that makes you cry? That thing that makes you weep and makes you sad and brokenhearted, it will be right there in your mind, and the tears will flow, but they'll all be wiped away. And that thing that causes you grief and covers you like a sheet and keeps you from the light of the Lord will be removed. This is what Isaiah said. Not only that, this is the last picture, it's so beautiful. The one enemy that we all fear and we will all face, death itself, at this meal, death itself will be swallowed up by the Lord, and it will be no more. And so all pain and grief and misery will be taken away. The fear of death will be removed forever, and those people at that banquet will feast on the richest food imaginable. This is the vision that Isaiah paints of what it will be like at the end of the days. Let me ask you this. Do you want to be at a banquet like that? This is the last thing that Isaiah said, and it's astounding. Because the question that this picture would raise in the mind of every religious person then, and it should raise in our minds now, is who's invited and who gets to come to the banquet? And what Isaiah said was this banquet is a banquet for all people, for all nations. And you have to understand, in the ears of the Israelites, the people who had been chosen by God, this was astounding to think that the pagan neighbors who were always a threat to them were also invited to this banquet. It was revolutionary to think that God would do this. But that's what Isaiah said would happen. This guest wants to know what Jesus thinks about that. This guest knows something else. Isaiah was not the last person to talk about this banquet. Maybe some of you have heard of the book of Enoch. About 300 or 400 years after Isaiah shared this vision, there was another book that came out called the book of Enoch, 200 years before Jesus' meal here. You know, in Enoch, the messianic banquet is also described. In Enoch, it's similar in regards to its joyousness. In Enoch, not only are the Jews or the Israelites invited, but the Gentiles are also invited. But there's one thing that's quite different in Enoch's version. The angel of the Lord is present with a sword, and the angel of the Lord will slaughter all of the Gentiles at the banquet. And those guests from Israel will have to wade through the blood and gore to get to the food. It's kind of, it's not quite as nice a banquet, is it? Enoch had this vision. Enoch had the question, who's invited? And Enoch had an answer. It can't possibly be that all people are invited. Just the Israelites are invited. Any Gentile shows up and they face death. This is not the last time that a community put together their own version of this story that Isaiah told. The Qumran community, closer to Jesus' day. In fact, these were people who were alive at the time of Christ. Maybe you've heard of the caves. What are they called? Help me out, someone.
Dead Sea Scrolls.
The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in the caves of Qumran. You can see pictures of this. You can go there. Knock them on. This guy knows all about it. Ask him after church. The Qumran community had their own version of it. I want to read it to you. They had a text that describe the Messianic banquet and answer the question again, who will be there? This is how they put it. The Messiah of Israel will come, and the chiefs of the clans of Israel shall sit before him, each in the order of his dignity, according to his place in their camps and marches. That is, this Messiah will come, he will set a banquet, and the most important people among us, the chiefs, the ones who stand the tallest and are the best behaved, they will stand close to him. Goes on to say this, and yet no one can attend this banquet who is paralyzed in his feet or his hands or lame or blind or deaf or dumb or smitten in the flesh with any visible blemish. Not only in the Qumran's version of this, in the Qumran community's version of this banquet, not only will the Gentiles not be invited, but if you're a person of Israel and you suffer in any way, if you're paralyzed or lame or blind or your skin isn't right, they would say, this is a sign that God doesn't want this person at his banquet, and so they're not invited. All of this, all of these were in the minds of that person that evening who sat at the table with Jesus and said, blessed is anyone who gets to sit at this meal, with the implied question, what do you think, Jesus? Who gets to sit at the table? Now we're going to look at Jesus' story. Now before we do, I want you to understand. Maybe you think you're one of the only people who struggles with the question of whether you are worthy of sitting at the table with this God. You're not. There are many people that I know personally who look at themselves and say, I can't possibly be good enough to sit at the meal which God will prepare. Oh, if I could only hide myself from him well enough to be welcomed. You can't hide yourself. And you're not the only person who thinks you're not welcome. And I'll tell you this on the other side. There are some here who sit this morning in their self-righteousness and think, I'm welcome, but I know who's not. It's these other people around me. And I'll tell you, my behavior often reveals that I myself struggle with this. Let's look at what Jesus says about this meal. Here's what he did. He looked at them and told a story. He said, someone gave a great dinner and invited many. At the time for the dinner, he sent his slave to say to those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. But they all alike began to make excuses. Now I want to stop for a moment because the etiquette around banquet invitations is slightly different in Jesus' time than it is in our time, largely because of the difference in access to food. If you want to throw a banquet, what do? You go to Costco. They did not have that then. Here's how banquets worked. When a nobleman in a region, in a village, decided to extend his hospitality and his grace to the people in the area, he would have his servants bring invitations to the surrounding area. And those invitations would say simply, we're planning a banquet on this date, would you come? Now, after those invitations are responded to, and then the nobleman receives the responses, he tallies how many people will plan to come, and then, on the basis of their saying whether they would come or not, he prepares the meal accordingly. If everyone responds that they're going to come, then he'll have to get more animals than if only half the people say they're going to come. And those animals are then brought into this to the place, and they cut them, and they slash them, and the blood flashes and all that. It's a mess, right? But it takes a lot of work. And the amount of work that's done on the day of the banquet depends on who said they were going to come. Now, in Jesus' story, this first invitation goes out. The nobleman tells all the people, you are invited. Based on how many respond, the meal is prepared. And then comes the day when the meal is all ready. And the servant is sent out a second time to all of those people who said they were going to come to tell them everything is ready now. You got it? Jesus tells this group of men around this table that evening, and the women who were there pushed off on the sides, probably weren't going to be allowed at the final banquet because they were women. He tells them, a man set a banquet, invited everyone, and then when the day came for the meal to be eaten, they all began to make excuses. Now look at the excuses they made. There are three. The next part of the story, there are three people that Jesus describes who respond to the invitation to the banquet in these ways. The first one. The first said to him, I have bought a piece of land and I must go out and see it. Please accept my regrets. The first person to respond to the servant's announcement that the meal is now ready says, I can't come because I've just bought a piece of land and I have to go see it. Please accept my apologies, I won't be coming. Now, when we hear that, it sounds reasonable enough, although we might think, well, you know, maybe he could look at it later. He should come to the meal. He said he would. But I want you to listen to this excuse in the ears of the noblemen of the first century. Let me tell you something about buying land. If you've ever been over to the region where this story was told, you know that there's not a lot of good land there. Have you seen pictures of the region around the Dead Sea? The Dead Sea? It's not the Living Sea. But there's not a lot of good land there. The only reason that a person would buy land was not for a vacation home or to have a bigger yard. Everyone had a yard that was big enough. The only reason you buy land is to grow food. Now, in an atmosphere like this atmosphere, you knew that in order for a piece of land to be productive, it had to have just the right elements to it. It had to face the winter sun, or otherwise there's no chance that crops could grow. It had to have good drainage. When the rains did come, which was not very often, the rain had to spread out on the land well, or otherwise the crops would never grow. It also, if it were terraced, the terraces had to be made properly. And it had to have the potential for good soil. Now, none of these things could a man possibly judge without going to look at the land first. And not only just going to look at it once, but spend months going over and again to see how the land fared in different growing seasons. Everybody at that dinner that night would know that only after spending about a year going to a piece of land and checking it out would anyone ever buy it. So do you know what this is right here? This is a ludicrous excuse. Do you know the word ludicrous? I'm not the musician, but the word. It means just totally and absolutely ridiculous. Because no one would ever buy a piece of land without surveying it for a year. It would be like I'm coming home late from the office, and I call Michelle, my wife, and tell her, I'm late because on a whim, I bought a house on eBay and I just want to go look at it. It's absolutely absurd. Now I want you to look at the second excuse that's given. Another said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I am going to try them out. Please accept my regrets. Again, this is an agrarian society where people live by growing things and eating and selling what they don't eat. And so oxen are an important part of this economy. They're not cheap. They're expensive. Do you know what a yoke of oxen is? Many of you know this. In order to pull the plow or to make a cart go from here to there, the way a farmer worked was by putting 2 oxen side by side and then attaching the 2 of them together with something called a yoke. This would be sort of a wooden bar with 2 metal scoops beneath, and these 2 oxen would be tied together, and that was sort of the basic machinery for the farm. Like a tractor today, you got yoke of oxen then. This person tells the servant, I can't come because I just bought 5 yoke of oxen. That's a lot of money. Like 5 tractors. And then tells him, I have to go try them out. Now I want you to know again, a similarly ludicrous excuse. Because in order for a yoke of oxen to be worth anything, the 2 oxen have to be matched properly. They're tied together. There's 3 things about them. They have to both be equally strong. Because if they're not, one will always be pulling faster than the other, and the cart will always turn. They both have to tire at the same rate. Same reason. If one of them's weak and gets tired, it'll start to turn. The cart won't work as it's supposed to. And they have to get along with each other. They're going to be tied together. And oxes apparently, I don't know this, but I read this, they apparently don't always get along. And because of this, there's no way a farmer would ever buy even 1 yoke of oxen without first trying them out, giving them a test drive, going to the dealership, and, you know. Again, we have an absolutely ridiculous excuse. Okay, let's look at the third one. The third one says, I've just been married and therefore I cannot come. This one's very short. Marriage took a really long time to happen then. There was a period of engagement, and then there was the official sort of handing over of documentation from the woman's family to the husband's family. There was the dowry, there was the travel, there was the going to get her, bringing her back, and then all the other stuff. This was not something that happened on the drop of a dime. If a person had been invited to the banquet, and was in the process of getting married, there's no way they would have said they could come. And so this, again, is an absolutely ridiculous and foolish excuse. Now, I want you to see what happens next. This is in the story that Jesus tells. These three excuses are then reported back as the slave returns and reports it to his master. Now, I want you to notice this. All three of these people, all alike, made ridiculous excuses for their own decisions not to come to the banquet. They are not going to be at the banquet because they've decided not to be, and each one of them has justified their choice not to be there with an excuse, and all three of them are ridiculous. But I want to say this as frankly and as plainly as I can. I'm afraid that you and I also, and many, many, many people who come weekly to churches and seek to follow God and be his disciples, act frighteningly like these three. Making excuses in our own choices not to do what God has invited us to do. I want you to listen to this for a moment. Here's the picture that the New Testament paints. Ready? God looked at the world, and what he saw was men and women who were lost in the darkness. God did not like this, did not want it to be so. And so God decided to send a light into this darkness, to send a light into the world so that those people who were lost and confused and alone in the shadows would be illuminated, so that every one of us who in our own loneliness was lost and facing a life of meaninglessness would have the light of true light shine into us. God himself came in Jesus Christ to illuminate our lostness. And in this coming into the world, God presents each one of us, every single man and woman, every person who's here and the people who are not here, with a very simple solution to the deepest and most agonizing loss that every one of us feels. We are all broken and empty on the inside. And so God comes into the world to fill us up. And in doing that, gives us himself, and in fact fills the yawning chasm that is aching at the heart of every single man and woman. And along with this gift comes a task. Now let me say, before I say something about the task, many of you who are here this morning have heard repeatedly that God loves you. Haven't you heard this? That God created you for a reason. Haven't you heard this? That God calls you, and in Jesus Christ calls you to follow him. You've heard this, haven't you? This gift of God's giving to us, himself, also comes with a task. And the task is this, listen. The task is to believing this good news and accepting this healing grace and love of the Father, that you and I should go out into the world as the bearers of this good news to people who don't know it. That we should live day in and day out in joyful obedience and in a thankful response of following after Jesus in our lives every day and in all of the places we find ourselves. With all the people that we confront, we're called to be the bearers of this grace, the witness to God's love in Jesus Christ. This is the task that has been given with this great gift to all of us. And do you know what we do? And what I do? Is I stand before God, who has invited me to work with him in this world, who has invited me to be his witness in the world. And do you know what I do? I give him ludicrous excuses for why I can't do it. Let me say this. The task that he invites you to and me to, do you know what it would be like for us to live into this task? Do you know what it would be like for you to go out into the world as a true witness to God's love and grace? Do you know what it would be like? It would be like eating at this heavenly banquet. You would find, the more you serve him and the more you become the witness that he's called you to be, that all of your hungers are satisfied. The ones that you could never satisfy in any other way are satisfied as if you were eating good food and drinking fine wine with the Master in a place where he wiped away your tears and took away death from your life for now and forever. That's what it would be like if any one of us became a witness of his. But over and over again, we come up with reasons why we can't do it. We blame the people around us. You know, nobody reaches out to me, and no one includes me, and no one really cares about me, and so I don't have the companionship that I need to go and serve God. Or we blame the churches that we're a part of. You know, there's no one there really my age, and I don't really have good fellowship there because the Christians are either behind me or ahead of me, and There's no real group there meeting the needs of my child. We blame God. God hasn't made it clear enough what he wants from me, and he also hasn't made me gifted enough, and I don't really know. I can't really do it. I think the most common one is that we blame our schedules. I'm too busy. I don't have time. There's so many important things that I need to do. Do you know what every one of these excuses sounds like in the ears of the master? I just bought a piece of land and I need to go see it. I just bought 5 yoke of oxen and I need to test them out. I just got married, I can't come. Excuse me. How does God respond when we do this? When I, or when you, are not the men and women that he needs us to be. Look how the master responds to hearing the servant's news that these people have made excuses and decided not to come. Then the owner of the house became angry. You know, that popular Christian imagination does not like to think of God as one who gets angry. You agree? Christian Andrew's imagination does not like to think of God as angry. When I was a kid, I went to summer camp. Did anyone here ever go to summer camp? I remember the first night of summer camp. The head counselor gave all the rules. And afterward, I was terrified because this counselor seemed severe. If we broke the rules, it would be bad. That night, at bunk time, the guy who was sleeping up there, he'd been to camp before. You know what he told me? That counselor's a big pushover. If you do something wrong, all you need to do is put on a sad face and pretend you're really sorry, and he'll forgive you every time. Oh, it's so easy. Just act sincere, and he'll let you push him all over the place. Do you know what I did that week? I was terrible. I had all the fun I could breaking the rules because I knew that counselor's job was to be nice and forgive me. All I had to do was pretend I was sorry. It didn't matter if I really was. I just had to say it in a way that seemed sincere. Do you know, I and many of us treat God like that counselor. We think it should never be true that God should be angry. How could God be angry? God's job is to be nice and to love me and to forgive me no matter what. I'm telling you, this attitude prevails, and there's a part of me that wants that to be true. But Jesus' story depicts an owner of a house who gets angry. And I want to ask you this for a moment, because at first I don't like this, but when I think about it, I actually like this. Do you think it would be okay if you extended your invitation over and over again to some of your good friends? And not just an invitation for them to come and do something laborious for themselves, but actually to come to your home so that you could lavish good gifts upon them. Would you be angry if they made lame excuses to you over and over again? Would you? Yes, of course you would. Why would we expect that God would not be angry at such a thing? If you had a relationship with someone who you cared about, and you tried over and over again to do good things for them, and they just spurned your every offer of goodness, would you expect that you should not feel angry toward them? No, of course not. For some reason, it's infected our ideas about God, that he should be like some cosmic doormat, or some good old camp counselor who just wants us to have a good weekend and who our parents are paying enough so he should forgive us. But that's not what God is like in this story. And I don't think it's what God is like in reality. I think it matters what we do with what God gives us. And the God who we meet in the stories that Jesus tells gets mad when we spurn his good invitation. And that's what this was. Now, the question, of course, then is, what does God do with his anger? Now, if you read the rest of this story, I want to tell you something, and it is surprising. And it would be especially surprising to everyone who heard that story that morning or that evening when Jesus told it. If they heard him tell this story at this point, they, of course, would say, of course the host is going to be angry. And what they would be expecting next is that host sent his servants out with their slayer's sides and sliced up those invited. They would expect that. But you don't get that in this story. With his anger, the host does not retaliate against those who were initially invited at all. The host does not turn that anger into some form of retribution or punishment or destruction to those who were first invited and made those lame excuses. That does not mean there's no consequence. Look at how this story ends. Jesus ends his story by saying, I tell you, those who were invited none of those who were invited will taste my dinner. There is a consequence. And the consequence is if you choose not to go to the banquet, you won't eat any of the food. Which it should put before all of us a question. Will we respond to the invitation that has come to us now and comes over and over again? Will we respond by going to the banquet or not? If we do not respond, God will be angry, but he does not use his anger against us. What is used against us is our own choice not to go, and we will not taste the banquet. Look what does happen with this anger. This is astounding. After receiving news of the rejection, this is what the owner does. The owner said to his slave, go out at once into the streets and lanes of the town and bring in the poor, the cripples, the blind, and the lame. Do you know who that list is? Do you remember the thing I read you from Qumran? In Jesus' story, he's telling all those around the table who sit and believe they're entitled alone, and they only are entitled to a place at God's table. Jesus tells them a story. You have been invited, and you have not chosen to come. And therefore, you will not eat the meal because you are not coming. And what God is going to do is send his servants out into the lanes and invite the very people that you've decided should have no part at the banquet that God serves, to his banquet. They are the ones that are going to get an invitation to come. And so, in Jesus' story, the master sends those servants out and says, you invite those very people that the religious folks have decided should have no part in the master's meal. Now, I want you to think for a moment. Who are the people that you would never think would be worthy to sit with God at this banquet? Whoever those people are in your mind, you must understand that in Jesus' picture of God, they are the very ones that he is sending his servants out into the world to invite to the meal. And I will tell you, those of us who are in leadership positions in the church, whether it's in the middle school group or the high school ministry or adult ministry, or whether you're a person who speaks up here or whatever area you lead in this church, you should understand that your calling is to be like these servants, going out to invite the people who no one else would ever think would be worthy to sit with God. Not because you're nice or because it's a good idea for us, but because that's the God that Jesus tells us about. He's the one who invites those unmentionable people who would never be welcomed at a meal like this, who at that very table where Jesus was telling the story were pushed to the borders and outside. They're the ones that are invited by the master's order. That's who God is. Look at the next phrase there. The servant does what this master says. Sir, what you ordered has been done, and there is still room. Incidentally, those of you who are worshiping irregularly, does that remind you of the title of a song that we sing? That song, we're going to sing it after the sermon. It comes right from this text. Oh, there are so many churches, and there are so many Christian people who believe there's not enough room at God's table, and who believe it's up to them to decide who's allowed to be there. And in so many of those instances, it's the people who are just like me who are allowed to be, and everyone else is pushed out. But in Jesus' offensive story to the religious people, it's those very folks who God wants to have close to him, to give to them his joy and his provision and his care and love, that the religious establishment will push away and say, you have no part in this. There still is room. There's one last movement here, and this to me is the most astounding. After the servant comes back and says, we've gone out into the village. We brought all of those people that we've pushed to the borders. We brought them in. And there's still room. The master says one other thing. He says, okay. Go out into the roads and the lanes. The roads and the lanes, incidentally, would be at the borders of this village and beyond. To the abandoned waste places in between villages where there's nothing going on. Go out into those places, he says. And compel people to come in so that my house may be filled. This one verse here, compel people to come in. Has anyone here heard of the Spanish Inquisition? This is a time in the history of the church where the church propagated enormous evil against other people, violence and cruelty and even murder, in order to try to convince people who were of one religious faith to come over into another religious faith. And they use this text here to justify that sort of action. That is a total misunderstanding of this text. The reason that the people who live in the borders of the city needed to be compelled to come in was not because they already had a religion that they really loved and wanted to stay with it. Do you know why they needed to be compelled to come? Because they would never believe that they were allowed to sit at the table of a nobleman eating his rich food with all the people who mattered in the world. They needed to be compelled because the news of the acceptance of this master in their ears would sound like a fable. They would never believe that they, as bad as they were, and as awful as they were, and as far away from him as they were, would ever be allowed to sit at his table. I once in my life have seen someone who was just like this. I have a friend who does not believe that he can be forgiven by God. I was with him one afternoon. It was pouring rain. I searched him out, and I found him sitting in a cabin, a broken-down cabin at a retreat center all by himself. I opened the door, and he was sitting on a rusted-out bed frame with a mattress that was in shambles, and he was crying his eyes out. I asked him what was going on. He told me about some cruelty that he had propagated against his sister. And then he explained how another girl had extended a hand of friendship and forgiveness, and he had spurned it in a cruel way, and he sat there weeping. I just was quiet as I heard the rain tapping on the roof of this shed and beating against the window panes. He was broken. As I listened, it occurred to me, tell him that he's forgiven. Tell him that you know, Christian, that the God who had created him and saw all of this wickedness in him still forgives him and loves him and wants to draw him near. This was stirring around in my mind. Tell him, Christian. He sobbed. I was silent. And then finally I opened my mouth and I said, you know God forgives you. And do you know what he said? No, he can't. Impossible. There's no way he could ever forgive me. I won't believe it. I don't believe it. I'll never believe it. And he went on crying. He was just like those people that Jesus spoke of, the ones who were so far away that they need someone to compel them to come in. And you know, I tell this story this morning because I believe there's a part of that young man in many of us in here this morning. A part of us that could never believe that we also would be welcomed at the table. But this story proclaims it. And not just this story that Jesus told, but the whole message of the Scriptures. That God goes out and invites sinners like us to come to the table. And though we may make many excuses for why we can't come, we are free to come and called to do so. Now, Jesus told these stories not just to put ideas in people's minds, but to push people to decision. And I tell it in the same spirit as he did. What if we took this story and this picture of God seriously? I'll tell you, these are at least two things would happen. One is that we would no longer be a community that had any boundaries around who was welcome. That we would let go of every behavior of ours, every attitude, every action that would draw boundaries around people who are not welcomed. And we would be reckless in who we included and thought was welcomed at the banquet of the Master. And I will tell you that all of us should let this picture shape us in that way, so that as a church and as individuals, we no longer put boundaries up around who's allowed to share such an intimate thing as a meal with us. That's one thing. Here's the second thing, and this is a decision that some of you need to make this morning. We would no longer frame any vain excuses for staying away from the table. But we would come today, knowing that Christ bids us to come, and that it's His grace and love and mercy that gives us our place at the table. Some of you have been waiting, thinking, once I get myself in order, once I shape up a bit, then I'll come to the Master. No, you must listen. This story bids you to come now. And what that means is to say in your mind and in your heart, to pray quietly, saying, God, I am ready to give myself to you entirely. I know I belong to you already. Take me and make of me the man or the woman that you want in the world. There are people in here who have never done that. You need to do that. What I'm going to do is this. This is what we're going to do now. I'm going to pray. As I'm praying, I'm going to ask the musicians to come up. When we're done praying, they are going to lead us in the song, There Still Is Room. And we're going to sing that together. And as we sing that, I want you to let that be your prayer. Why don't you guys come on up now? Musicians, please, come on up. I want them to get the song going as I finish praying. And I want you to choose to come. Now let's pray.